living in another world far away. Or this. A little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep or taste not the Pierian spring. There shallow draughts intoxicate the brain, and drinking largely sobers us again. Pope, same essay. Where does that put you? Montag bit his lip. I'll tell you, said Beatty, smiling at his cards. That made you, for a little while, a drunkard. Read a few lines, and off you go over the cliff. Bang! You're ready to blow up the world, chop off heads. Knock down women and children, destroy authority. I know. I've been through it all.
I'm all right, said Montag nervously.
Stop blushing. I'm not needling, really, I'm not. Do you know? I had a dream an hour ago. I lay down for a cat nap, and in this dream, you and I, Montag, got into a furious debate on books. You towered with rage, yelled quotes at me. I calmly parried every thrust. Power, I said. And you, quoting Dr. Johnson, said, knowledge is more than equivalent to force. And I said, well, Dr. Johnson also said, dear boy, that he is no wise man that will quit a certainty for an uncertainty. Stick with the fireman, Montag. All else is dreary chaos. Don't listen, whispered Faber. He's trying to confuse. He's slippery. Watch out. Beatty chuckled. And you said, quoting, truth will come to light. Murder will not be hid long. And I cried in good humor, oh God, he speaks only of his horse. And the devil can cite scripture for his purpose. And you yelled, this age thinks better of a gilded fool than of a threadbare saint in wisdom's school. And I whispered gently, the dignity of truth is lost with much protesting. And you screamed, carcasses bleed at the sight of the murderer. And I said, patting your hand, what, do I give you trench mouth? And you shrieked, knowledge is power. And a dwarf on a giant's shoulder sees the farthest of the two. And I summed my side up with rare serenity in the folly of mistaking a metaphor for a proof, a torrent of verbiage for a spring of capital truths, and oneself as an oracle, is inborn in us, Mr. Valerie once said. Montag's head whirled, sickeningly. He felt beaten unmercifully on brow, eyes, nose, lips, chin, on shoulders, on upflailing arms. He wanted to yell, no, shut up, you're confusing things, stop it. Beatty's graceful fingers thrust out to seize his wrist. God, what a pulse. I've got you going, have I, Montag? Jesus, God, your pulse sounds like the day after the war. Everything but sirens and bells. Shall I talk some more? I like your look of panic. Swahili, Indian, English lit, I speak them all. A kind of excellent dumb discourse, Willie. Montag, hold on. The moth brushed Montag's ear. He's muddying the waters. Oh, you were scared silly, said Beatty. For I was doing a terrible thing in using the very books you clung to rebut you on every hand, on every point. What traitor's books can be? You think they're backing you up and they turn on you. Others can use them too, and there you are, lost in the middle of the moor in a great welter of nouns and verbs and adjectives. And at the very end of my dream, along I came with the salamander and said, going my way? And you got in, and we drove back to the firehouse in beatific silence. All dwindled away to peace. Beatty let Montag's wrist go, let the hand slump limply on the table. All's well that is well in the end. Silence. Montag sat like a carved white stone. The echo of the final hammer on his skull died slowly away into the black cavern where Faber waited for the echoes to subside. And then when the startled dust had settled down about Montag's mind, Faber began softly. All right, he's had his say. You must take it in. I'll say my say, too, in the next few hours. And you'll take it in. And you'll try to judge them and make your decisions as to which way to jump or fall. But I want it to be your decision, not mine, and not the captain's. But remember that the captain belongs to the most dangerous enemy to truth and freedom, the solid, unmoving cattle
of the majority. Oh, God, the terrible tyranny of the majority. We all have our harps to play, and it's up to you now to know with which ear you'll listen.
Montag opened his mouth to answer Faber and was saved this error in the presence of others when the station bell rang. The alarm voice in the ceiling chanted. There was a tacking-tacking sound as the alarm report telephone typed out the address across the room. Captain Beatty, his poker cards in one pink hand, walked with exaggerated slowness to the phone and ripped out the address when the report was finished. He glanced perfunctorily at it and shoved it in his pocket. He came back and sat down. The others looked at him.
"It can wait exactly 40 seconds
while I take all the money away from you," said Beatty happily. Montag put his cards down.
"Tired, Montag? Going out of this game?"
"Yes."
"Hold on. Well, come to think of it, we can finish this hand later. Just leave your cards face down and hustle the equipment.
On the double now." And Beatty rose up again.
"Montag, you don't look well. I'd hate to think you were coming down with another fever."
"I'll be all right."
"You'll be fine. This is a special case. Come on, jump for it."
They leapt into the air and clutched the brass pole as if it were the last vantage point above a tidal wave passing below. And then the brass pole, to their dismay, slid them down into darkness, into the blast and cough and suction of the gaseous dragon roaring to life.
"Hey!"
They rounded a corner in thunder and siren, with concussion of tires, with scream of rubber, with a shift of kerosene bulk in the glittery brass tank, like the food in the stomach of a giant, with Montag's fingers jolting off the silver rail, swinging into cold space, with the wind tearing his hair back from his head, with the wind whistling in his teeth, and him all the while thinking of the women. The chaff women in his parlor tonight, with the kernels blown out from under them by a neon wind, and his silly damned reading of a book to them. How like trying to put out fires with water pistols, how senseless and insane. One rage turned in for another, one anger displacing another. When would he stop being entirely mad and be quiet? Be very quiet indeed.
"Here we go."
Montag looked up. Beatty never drove, but he was driving tonight, slamming the salamander around corners, leaning forward high on the driver's throne, his massive black slicker flapping out behind, so that he seemed a great black bat flying above the engine, over the brass numbers, taking the full wind.
"Here we go to keep the world happy, Montag."
Beatty's pink, phosphorescent cheeks glimmered in the high darkness, and he was smiling furiously.
"Here we are."
The salamander boomed to a halt, throwing men off in slips and clumsy hops. Montag stood, fixing his raw eyes to the cold, bright rail under his clenched fingers.
"I can't do it," he thought. "How can I go with this new assignment? How can I go on burning things? I can't go in this place."
Beatty, smelling of the wind through which he had rushed, was at Montag's elbow.
"All right, Montag."
The men ran like cripples in their clumsy boots, as quietly as spiders. At last, Montag raised his eyes and turned. Beatty was watching his face.
"Something the matter, Montag?"
"Why," said Montag slowly, "we've stopped in front of my house."
Part 3. Burning Bright. Lights flicked on, and house doors opened all down the street to watch the carnival set up. Montag and Beatty stared, one with dry satisfaction, the other with disbelief, at the house before them, this main ring in which torches would be juggled and fire eaten.
"Well," said Beatty, "now you did it. Old Montag wanted to fly near the sun, and now that he's burnt his damn wings, he wonders why. Didn't I hint enough when I sent the hound around your place?"
Montag's face was entirely numb and featureless. He felt his head turn like a stone carving to the dark place next door, set in its bright border of flowers. Beatty snorted.
"Oh, no. You weren't fooled by that little idiot's routine, were you? Flowers, butterflies, leaves, sunsets? Oh, hell.
It's all in a file. I'll be damned, I've hit the bullseye. Look at the sick look on your face. A few grass blades and the quarters of the moon, what trash. What good did she ever do with all that?
Montag sat on the cold fender of the Dragon, moving his head half an inch to the left, half an inch to the right, left, right, left, right, left.
She saw everything. She didn't do anything to anyone. She just let them alone.
Alone, hell! She chewed around you, didn't she? One of those damn do-gooders with their shocked, holier-than-thou silences. Their one talent, making others feel guilty. God damn you, they rise like a midnight sun to sweat you in your bed.
The front door opened. Mildred came down the steps running, one suitcase held with a dreamlike, clenching rigidity in her fist, as a beetle taxi hissed to the curb.
Mildred!
She ran past, with her body stiff, her face floured with powder, her mouth gone, without lipstick.
Mildred, you didn't put in the alarm!
She shoved the valise in the waiting beetle, climbed in, and sat mumbling.
Poor family. Poor family. Oh, everything gone. Everything. Everything gone now.
Beatty grabbed Montag's shoulder as the beetle blasted away and hit 70 miles an hour, far down the street. Gone. There was a crash, like the falling parts of a dream, fashioned out of warped glass, mirrors, and crystal prisms. Montag drifted about as if still another incomprehensible storm had turned him, to see Stoneman and Black wielding axes, shattering window panes to provide cross-ventilation. The brush of a death's head moth against a cold black screen. Montag, this is Faber. Do you hear me? What's happening?
This is happening. To me, said Montag.
What a dreadful surprise, said Beatty. For everyone nowadays knows, absolutely is certain, that nothing will ever happen to me. Others die, I go on. There are no consequences and no responsibilities.
Except that there are.
But let's not talk about them, eh? By the time the consequences catch up with you, it's too late, isn't it, Montag?
Montag, can you get away? Run,
asked Faber.
Montag walked, but did not feel his feet touch the cement, and then the night grasses. Beatty flicked his igniter nearby, and the small orange flame drew his fascinated gaze.
What is there about fire that's so lovely? No matter what age we are, what draws us to it?
Beatty blew out the flame and lit it again.
It's perpetual motion. The thing man wanted to invent but never did. Or almost perpetual motion. If you let it go on, it'd burn our lifetimes out. What is fire? It's a mystery. Scientists give us gobbledygook about friction and molecules, but they don't really know. Its real beauty is that it destroys responsibility and consequences. A problem gets too burdensome, then into the furnace with it. Now, Montag, you're a burden. And the fire will lift you off my shoulders, clean, quick, sure. Nothing to rot later. Antibiotic. Aesthetic. Practical.
Montag stood looking in now at this queer house, made strange by the hour of the night, by murmuring neighbor voices, by littered glass. And there on the floor, their covers torn off and spilled out like swan feathers, the incredible books that looked so silly and really not worth bothering with, for these were nothing but black type and yellowed paper and raveled binding.
Mildred, of course.
She must have watched him hide the books in the garden and brought them back in. Mildred.
Mildred.
I want you to do this job all by your lonesome, Montag. Not with kerosene and a match, but piecework with a flamethrower. Your house, your cleanup.
Montag, can't you run? Get away.
No, cried Montag helplessly. The hound. Because of the hound.
Faber heard, and Beatty, thinking it was meant for him, heard.
Yes, the hound's somewhere about the neighborhood, so don't try anything.
Ready? Ready.
Montag snapped the safety catch on the flamethrower.
Fire!
A great nuzzling gout of fire leapt out, to lap at the books and knock them against the wall. He stepped into the bedroom and fired twice, and the twin beds went up in a great simmering whisper, with more heat and passion and light than he would have supposed them to contain. He burnt the bedroom walls and the cosmetics chest because he wanted to change everything, the chairs, the tables, and in the dining room, the silverware and plastic dishes, everything that showed that he had lived here in this empty house with a strange woman who would forget him tomorrow, who had gone and quite forgotten him already, listening to her seashell radio pour in on her, and in on her as she rode across town alone. And as before, it was good to burn. He felt himself gush out in the fire, snatch, rend, rip in half with flame, and put away the senseless problem. If there was no solution, well, then now there was no problem either. Fire was best for everything. The books, Montag. The books leapt and danced like roasted birds, their wings ablaze with red and yellow feathers. And then he came to the parlor, where the great idiot monsters lay asleep with their white thoughts and their snowy dreams. And he shot a bolt at each of the three blank walls, and the vacuum hissed out at him. The emptiness made an even emptier whistle, a senseless scream. He tried to think about the vacuum upon which the nothingnesses had performed. But he could not. He held his breath so the vacuum could not get into his lungs. He cut off its terrible emptiness, drew back, and gave the entire room a gift of one huge, bright yellow flower of burning. The fireproof plastic sheath on everything was cut wide, and the house began to shudder with flame. "When you're quite finished," said Beatty behind him, "you're under arrest." The house fell in red coals and black ash. It bedded itself down in sleepy pink-gray cinders, and a smoke plume blew over it, rising and waving slowly back and forth in the sky. It was 3:30 in the morning. The crowd drew back into the houses. The great tents of the circus had slumped into charcoal and rubble, and the show was well over. Montag stood with the flamethrower in his limp hands, great islands of perspiration drenching his armpits, his face smeared with soot. The other firemen waited behind him in the darkness, their faces illumined faintly by the smoldering foundation. Montag started to speak twice, and then finally managed to put his thought together. "Was it my wife turned in the alarm?" Beatty nodded. "But her friends turned in an alarm earlier that I let ride. One way or the other, you'd have got it. It was pretty silly, quoting poetry around free and easy like that. It was the act of a silly damn snob. Give a man a few lines of verse and he thinks he's the lord of all creation. You think you can walk on water with your books? Well, the world can get by just fine without them. Look where they got you, in slime up to your lip. If I stir the slime with my little finger, you'll drown." Montag could not move. A great earthquake had come with fire and leveled the house, and Mildred was under there somewhere, and his entire life under there. And he could not move. The earthquake was still shaking and falling and shivering inside him, and he stood there, his knees half bent under the great load of tiredness and bewilderment and outrage, letting Beatty hit him without raising a hand. "Montag, you idiot. Montag, you damn fool. Why did you really do it?" Montag did not hear. He was far away. He was running with his mind. He was gone, leaving this dead, soot-covered body to sway in front of another raving fool. "Montag, get out of there," said Faber. Montag listened. Beatty struck him a blow on the head that sent him reeling back. The green bullet in which Faber's voice whispered and cried fell to the sidewalk. Beatty snatched it up, grinning. He held it half in, half out of his ear. Montag heard the distant voice calling, "Montag, you all right?" Beatty switched the green bullet off and thrust it in his pocket. "Well, so there's more here than I thought. I saw you tilt your head listening. First I thought you had a seashell. But when you turned clever later, I wondered, we'll trace this and drop it on your friend."
"No," said Montag.
He twitched the safety catch on the flamethrower. Beatty glanced instantly at Montag's fingers, and his eyes widened the faintest bit. Montag saw the surprise there, and himself glanced to his hands to see what new thing they had done. Thinking back later, he could never decide whether the hands or Beatty's reaction to the hands gave him the final push toward murder. The last rolling thunder of the avalanche stoned down about his ears, not touching him. Beatty grinned his most charming grin.
Well, that's one way to get an audience. Hold a gun on a man and force him to listen to your speech. Speech away. What'll it be this time? Why don't you belt Shakespeare at me, you fumbling snob? There is no terror, Cassius, in your threats, for I am armed so strong in honesty that they pass me as an idle wind, which I respect not. How's that? Go ahead now. You second-hand literateur, pull the trigger.
He took one step toward Montag. Montag only said,
We never burned right.
Hand it over, guy, said Beatty with a fixed smile. And then he was a shrieking blaze, a jumping, sprawling, gibbering mannequin, no longer human or known, all writhing flame on the lawn as Montag shot one continuous pulse of liquid fire on him. There was a hiss, like a great mouthful of spittle banging a red-hot stove, a bubbling and frothing, as if salt had been poured over a monstrous black snail to cause a terrible liquefaction and a boiling over of yellow foam. Montag shut his eyes, shouted, and fought to get his hands at his ears to clamp and to cut away the sound. Beatty flopped over and over and over, and at last twisted in on himself like a charred wax doll and lay silent. The other two firemen did not move. Montag kept his sickness down long enough to aim the flamethrower.
Turn around.
They turned, their faces blanched meat, streaming sweat. He beat their heads, knocking off their helmets and bringing them down on themselves. They fell and lay without moving. The blowing of a single autumn leaf. He turned, and the mechanical hound was there. It was half across the lawn, coming from the shadows, moving with such drifting ease that it was like a single solid cloud of black-gray smoke blown at him in silence. It made a single last leap into the air, coming down at Montag from a good 3 feet over his head, its spidered legs reaching, the procaine needle snapping out its single angry tooth. Montag caught it with a bloom of fire, a single wondrous blossom that curled in petals of yellow and blue and orange about the metal dog, clad it in a new covering as it slammed into Montag and threw him 10 feet back against the bole of a tree, taking the flame gun with him. He felt it scrabble and seize his leg and stab the needle in for a moment. Before the fire snapped the hound up in the air, burst its metal bones at the joints, and blew out its interior in a single flushing of red color like a skyrocket fastened to the street. Montag lay watching the dead, alive thing fiddle the air and die. Even now it seemed to want to get back at him and finish the injection, which was now working through the flesh of his leg. He felt all of the mingled relief and horror at having pulled back only in time to have just his knee slammed by the fender of a car hurtling by at 90 miles an hour. He was afraid to get up, afraid he might not be able to gain his feet at all with an anesthetized leg. A numbness in a numbness hollowed into a numbness. And now? The street empty, the house burnt like an ancient bit of stage scenery, the other homes dark. The hound here, Beatty there, the two other firemen another place, and the salamander? He gazed at the immense engine. That would have to go too. Well, he thought, let's see how badly off you are. On your feet now. Easy, easy. There. He stood, and he had only one leg. The other was like a chunk of burnt pine log he was carrying along as a penance for some obscure sin. When he put his weight on it, a shower of silver needles gushed up the length of the calf and went off in the knee. He wept. Come on. Come on, you. You can't stay here. A few house lights were going on again down the street. Whether from the incidents just passed or because of the abnormal silence following the fight, Montag did not know. He hobbled around the ruins, seizing at his bad leg when it lagged, talking and whimpering and shouting directions at it and cursing it and pleading with it to work for him now when it was vital. He heard a number of people crying out in the darkness and shouting. He reached the backyard and the alley. Beatty, he thought, you're not a problem now. You always said don't face a problem, burn it. Well, now I've done both. Goodbye, Captain. And he stumbled along the alley in the dark. A shotgun blast went off in his leg every time he put it down, and he thought, you're a fool, a damn fool, an awful fool, an idiot, an awful idiot, a damn idiot, and a fool, a damn fool. Look at the mess, and where's the mop? Look at the mess. And what do? Pride, damn it, and temper, and you've junked it all at the very start. You vomit on everyone and on yourself. But everything at once, but everything one on top of another. Beatty, the women, Mildred, Clarice, everything. No excuse, though, no excuse. A fool, a damn fool, go give yourself up. No, we'll save what we can. We'll do what there is left to do. If we have to burn, let's take a few more with us. Here. He remembered the books and turned back, just on the off chance. He found a few books where he had left them near the garden fence. Mildred, God bless her, had missed a few. 4 books still lay hidden where he had put them. Voices were wailing in the night, and flash beams swirled about. Other salamanders were roaring, their engines far away, and police sirens were cutting their way across town with their sirens. Montag took the 4 remaining books, and hopped his way down the alley, and suddenly fell, as if his head had been cut off and only his body lay there. Something inside had jerked him to a halt and flopped him down. He lay where he had fallen and sobbed, his legs folded, his face pressed blindly to the gravel. Beatty wanted to die. In the middle of the crying, Montag knew it for the truth. Beatty had wanted to die. He had just stood there, not really trying to save himself, just stood there, joking, needling, thought Montag. And the thought was enough to stifle his sobbing and let him pause for air. How strange, strange, to want to die so much, that you let a man walk around armed, and then instead of shutting up and staying alive, you go on yelling at people and making fun of them, until you get them mad. And then, at a distance, running feet, Montag sat up. Let's get out of here. Come on, get up. Get up. You just can't sit. But he was still crying, and that had to be finished. It was going away now. He hadn't wanted to kill anyone, not even Beatty. His flesh gripped him and shrank, as if it had been plunged in acid. He gagged. He saw Beatty, a torch, not moving, fluttering out on the grass. He bit at his knuckles. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Oh, God, sorry. He tried to piece it all together, to go back to the normal pattern of life a few short days ago, before the sieve and the sand, Denham's dentifrice, moth voices, fireflies, the alarms and excursions, too much for a few short days, too much indeed for a lifetime. Feet ran in the far end of the alley. Get up, he told himself. Damn it, get up, he said to the leg, and stood. The pains were spikes driven in the kneecap. And then only darning needles, and then only common ordinary safety pins. And after he had shagged along 50 more hops and jumps, filling his hand with slivers from the board fence, the prickling was like someone blowing a spray of scalding water on that leg. And the leg was at last his own leg again. He had been afraid that running might break the loose ankle. Now, sucking all the night into his open mouth and blowing it out, pale, with all the blackness left heavily inside himself, he set out in a steady jogging pace. He carried the books in his hands. He thought of Faber. Faber was back there in the steaming lump of tar that had no name or identity now. He had burnt Faber, too. He suddenly felt so shocked by this that he felt Faber was really dead, baked like a roach in that small green capsule shoved and lost in the pocket of a man who was now nothing but a frame skeleton strung with asphalt tendons.
You must remember, burn them, or they'll burn you, he thought. Right now it's as simple as that. He searched his pockets. The money was there. And in his other pocket he found the usual seashell upon which the city was talking to itself in the cold black morning.
Police alert. Wanted. Fugitive in city. Has committed murder and crimes against the state. Name, Guy Montag. Occupation, fireman. Last seen.
He ran steadily for 6 blocks in the alley, and then the alley opened out into a wide, empty thoroughfare 10 lanes wide. It seemed like a boatless river, frozen there in the raw light of the high white arc lamps. You could drown trying to cross it, he felt. It was too wide. It was too open. It was a vast stage without scenery, inviting him to run across, easily seen in the blazing illumination, easily caught, easily shot down. The seashell hummed in his ear.
Watch for a man running. Watch for the running man. Watch for a man alone on foot. Watch.
Montag pulled back in the shadows. Directly ahead lay a gas station, a great chunk of porcelain snow shining there, and 2 silver beetles pulling in to fill up. Now he must be clean and presentable if he wished to walk, not run, stroll calmly across that wide boulevard. It would give him an extra margin of safety if he washed up and combed his hair before he went on his way to get... where? Yes, he thought. Where am I running?
Nowhere.
There was nowhere to go. No friend to turn to, really. Except Faber. And then he realized that he was indeed running toward Faber's house instinctively. But Faber couldn't hide him. It would be suicide even to try. But he knew that he would go to see Faber anyway, for a few short minutes. Faber's would be the place where he might refuel his fast-draining belief in his own ability to survive. He just wanted to know that there was a man like Faber in the world. He wanted to see the man alive, and not burnt back there like a body shelled in another body. And some of the money must be left with Faber, of course, to be spent after Montag ran on his way. Perhaps he could make the open country and live on or near the rivers and near the highways in the fields and hills. A great whirling whisper made him look to the sky. The police helicopters were rising so far away that it seemed someone had blown the gray head off a dry dandelion flower. 2 dozen of them flurried, wavering, indecisive, 3 miles off, like butterflies puzzled by autumn. And then they were plummeting down to land one by one, here, there, softly kneading the streets, where, turned back to beetles, they shrieked along the boulevards, or as suddenly, leapt back into the air, continuing their search. And here was the gas station, its attendants busy now with customers. Approaching from the rear, Montag entered the men's washroom. Through the aluminum wall, he heard a radio voice saying,
"War has been declared."
The gas was being pumped outside. The men in the beetles were talking, and the attendants were talking about the engines, the gas, the money owed. Montag stood trying to make himself feel the shock of the quiet statement from the radio. But nothing would happen. The war would have to wait for him to come to it in his personal file. 1 hour, 2 hours from now. He washed his hands and face and toweled himself dry, making little sound. He came out of the washroom and shut the door carefully, and walked into the darkness, and at last stood again on the edge of the empty boulevard. There it lay. A game for him to win. A vast bowling alley in the cool morning. The boulevard was as clean as the surface of an arena 2 minutes before the appearance of certain unnamed victims and certain unknown killers. The air over and above the vast concrete river trembled with the warmth of Montag's body alone. It was incredible how he felt his temperature could cause the whole immediate world to vibrate. He was a phosphorescent target. He knew it. He felt it. And now he must begin his little walk. 3 blocks away, a few headlights glared. Montag drew a deep breath. His lungs were like burning brooms in his chest. His mouth was sucked dry from running. His throat tasted of bloody iron, and there was rusted steel in his feet. What about those lights there? Once you started walking, you'd have to gauge how fast those beetles could make it down here. Well, how far was it to the other curb?
It seemed like 100 yards. Probably not 100, but figure for that anyway. Figure that with him going very slowly at a nice stroll, it might take as much as 30 seconds, 40 seconds to walk all that way. The Beatles? Once started, they could leave 3 blocks behind them in about 15 seconds. So even if halfway across he started to run, he put his right foot out, and then his left foot, and then his right, he walked on the empty avenue. Even if the street were entirely empty, of course, you couldn't be sure of a safe crossing, for a car could appear suddenly over the rise 4 blocks farther on and be on and past you before you had taken a dozen breaths. He decided not to count his steps. He looked neither to left nor right. The light from the overhead lamp seemed as bright and revealing as the midday sun, and just as hot. He listened to the sound of the car picking up speed 2 blocks away on his right. Its movable headlights jerked back and forth suddenly, and caught at Montag. Keep going. Montag faltered, got a grip on the books, and forced himself not to freeze. Instinctively, he took a few quick running steps, then talked out loud to himself and pulled up to stroll again. He was now half across the street, but the roar from the Beatles' engines whined higher as it put on speed. The police, of course, they see me. But slow now, slow, quiet, don't turn, don't look, don't seem concerned. Walk, that's it. Walk. Walk. The Beetle was rushing. The Beetle was roaring. The Beetle raised its speed. The Beetle was whining. The Beetle was in high thunder. The Beetle came skimming. The Beetle came in a single whistling trajectory, fired from an invisible rifle. It was up to 120 miles per hour. It was up to 130 at least. Montag clamped his jaws. The heat of the racing headlights burnt his cheeks, it seemed, and jittered his eyelids and flushed the sour sweat out all over his body. He began to shuffle idiotically and talk to himself, and then he broke and just ran. He put out his legs as far as they would go and down and then far out again and down and back and out and down and back. God. God. He dropped a book, broke pace, almost turned, changed his mind, plunged on, yelling in concrete emptiness, the Beetle scuttling after its running food. 200. 100 feet away. 90. 80. 70. Montag gasping, flailing his hands, legs, up, down, out, up, down, out, closer, closer, hooting, calling. His eyes burnt white now as his head jerked about to confront the flashing glare. Now the Beetle was swallowed in its own light. Now it was nothing but a torch hurtling upon him, all sound, all blare. Now, almost on top of him. He stumbled and fell. I'm done. It's over. But the falling made a difference. An instant before reaching him, the wild Beetle cut and swerved out. It was gone. Montag lay flat, his head down. Wisps of laughter trailed back to him with the blue exhaust from the Beetle. His right hand was extended above him, flat. Across the extreme tip of his middle finger, he saw now, as he lifted that hand, a faint 1/16 of an inch of black tread where the tire had touched in passing. He looked at that black line with disbelief, getting to his feet. That wasn't the police, he thought. He looked down the boulevard. It was clear now. A car full of children, all ages, God knew, from 12 to 16, out whistling, yelling, hurrahing, had seen a man, a very extraordinary sight, a man strolling, a rarity, and simply said, "Let's get him," not knowing he was the fugitive Mr. Montag. Simply a number of children out for a long night of roaring 500 or 600 miles in a few moonlit hours, their faces icy with wind, and coming home or not coming at dawn, alive or not alive, that made the adventure. They would have killed me, thought Montag, swaying. The air still torn and stirring about him in dust, touching his bruised cheek. For no reason at all in the world, they would have killed me. He walked toward the far curb, telling each foot to go and keep going. Somehow he had picked up the spilled books. He didn't remember bending or touching them. He kept moving them from hand to hand as if they were a poker hand he could not figure. I wonder if they were the ones who killed Clarice. He stopped, and his mind said it again very loud.
I wonder if they were the ones who killed Clarice. He wanted to run after them, yelling. His eyes watered. The thing that had saved him was falling flat. The driver of that car, seeing Montag down, instinctively considered the probability that running over a body at such a high speed might turn the car upside down and spill them out. If Montag had remained an upright target, Montag gasped. Far down the boulevard, four blocks away, the Beetle had slowed, spun about on two wheels, and was now racing back, slanting over on the wrong side of the street, picking up speed. But Montag was gone, hidden in the safety of the dark alley for which he had set out on a long journey, an hour, or was it a minute, ago. He stood shivering in the night, looking back out as the Beetle ran by and skidded back to the center of the avenue, whirling laughter in the air all about it. Gone. Farther on, as Montag moved in darkness, he could see the helicopters falling, falling like the first flakes of snow in the long winter to come. The house was silent. Montag approached from the rear, creeping through a thick, night-moistened scent of daffodils and roses and wet grass. He touched the screen door in back, found it open, slipped in, moved across the porch, listening. "Mrs. Black, are you asleep in there?" he thought. "This isn't good. But your husband did it to others, and never asked, and never wondered, and never worried. And now, since you're a fireman's wife, it's your house and your turn. For all the houses your husband burnt, and the people he hurt, without thinking." The house did not reply. He hid the books in the kitchen, and moved from the house again to the alley, and looked back. And the house was still dark and quiet, sleeping. On his way across town, with the helicopters fluttering like torn bits of paper in the sky, he phoned the alarm at a lonely phone booth outside a store that was closed for the night. Then he stood in the cold night air waiting, and at a distance he heard the fire sirens start up and run, and the salamanders coming, coming to burn Mr. Black's house while he was away at work, to make his wife stand shivering in the morning air while the roof let go and dropped in upon the fire. But now she was still asleep. "Good night, Mrs. Black," he thought. Faber. Another rap, a whisper, and a long waiting. Then, after a minute, a small light flickered inside Faber's small house. After another pause, the back door opened. They stood looking at each other in the half-light, Faber and Montag, as if each did not believe in the other's existence. Then Faber moved and put out his hand, and grabbed Montag and moved him in and sat him down and went back and stood in the door listening. The sirens were wailing off in the morning distance. He came in and shut the door. Montag said, "I've been a fool all down the line. I can't stay long. I'm on my way God knows where."
"At least you were a fool about the right things," said Faber. "I thought you were dead. The audio capsule I gave you?
Burnt.
I heard the captain talking to you, and suddenly there was nothing. I almost came out looking for you."
"The captain's dead. He found the audio capsule, he heard your voice, he was going to trace it. I killed him with the flamethrower." Faber sat down and did not speak for a time. "My God, how did this happen?" said Montag. "It was only the other night everything was fine, and the next thing I know I'm drowning. How many times can a man go down and still be alive? I can't breathe. There's Beatty, dead, and he was my friend once. And there's Millie, gone. I thought she was my wife, but now I don't know. And the house, all burnt. And my job gone, and myself on the run, and I planted a book in a fireman's house on the way. Good Christ, the things I've done in a single week."
"You did what you had to do. It was coming on for a long time."
"Yes, I believe that. If there's nothing else I believe, it saved itself up to happen. I could feel it for a long time. I was saving something up. I went around doing one thing and feeling another. God, it was all there. It's a wonder it didn't show on me, like fat. And now here I am messing up your life too. They might follow me here."
"I feel alive for the first time in years," said Faber. "I feel I'm doing what I should have done a lifetime ago. For a little while, I'm not afraid."
Maybe it's because I'm doing the right thing at last. Maybe it's because I've done a rash thing and don't want to look the coward to you. I suppose I'll have to do even more violent things, exposing myself so I won't fall down on the job and turn scared again. What are your plans?
To keep running.
You know the war's on.
I heard.
God, isn't it funny, said the old man. It seems so remote, because we have our own troubles.
I haven't had time to think.
Montag drew out $100.
I want this to stay with you. Use it any way that'll help when I'm gone.
But
I might be dead by noon. Use this.
Faber nodded.
You'd better head for the river, if you can. Follow along it. And if you hit the old railroad lines going out into the country, follow them. Even though practically everything's airborne these days and most of the tracks are abandoned, the rails are still there, rusting. I've heard there are still hobo camps all across the country here and there. Walking camps, they call them. And if you keep walking far enough and keep an eye peeled, they say there's lots of old Harvard degrees on the tracks between here and Los Angeles. Most of them are wanted and hunted in the cities. They survive, I guess. There aren't many of them, and I guess the government's never considered them a great enough danger to go in and track them down. You might hole up with them for a time, and get in touch with me in St. Louis. I'm leaving on the 5 a.m. bus this morning to see a retired printer there. I'm getting out in the open myself, at last. This money will be put to good use. Thanks, and God bless you. Do you want to sleep a few minutes?
I'd better run.
Let's check.
He took Montag quickly into the bedroom and lifted a picture frame aside, revealing a television screen the size of a postal card.
I always wanted something very small, something I could walk to, something I could blot out with the palm of my hand if necessary. Nothing that could shout me down, nothing monstrous big. So, you see,
he snapped it on.
Montag, the TV set said, and lit up. M-O-N-T-A-G.
The name was spelled out by a voice.
Guy Montag. Still running? Police helicopters are up. A new mechanical hound has been brought from another district.
Montag and Faber looked at each other.
Mechanical hound never fails. Never since its first use in tracking quarry has this incredible invention made a mistake. Tonight, this network is proud to have the opportunity to follow the hound by camera helicopter as it starts on its way to the target.
Faber poured two glasses of whiskey.
We'll need these.
They drank.
Nose so sensitive, the mechanical hound can remember and identify 10,000 odor indexes on 10,000 men without resetting.
Faber trembled the least bit and looked about at his house, at the walls, the doorknob, and the chair where Montag now sat. Montag saw the look. They both looked quickly about the house, and Montag felt his nostrils dilate, and he knew that he was trying to track himself, and his nose was suddenly good enough to sense the path he had made in the air of the room, and the sweat of his hand hung from the doorknob, invisible, but as numerous as the jewels of a small chandelier. He was a luminous cloud, a ghost that made breathing once more impossible. He saw Faber stop up his own breath for fear of drawing that ghost into his own body, perhaps, being contaminated with the phantom exhalations and odors of a running man.
The mechanical hound is now landing by a helicopter at the site of the burning.
And there on the small screen was the burnt house and the crowd, and something with a sheet over it. And out of the sky, fluttering, came the helicopter like a grotesque flower.
So they must have their game out, thought Montag. The circus must go on, even with war beginning within the hour.
He watched the scene, fascinated, not wanting to move. It seemed so remote, and no part of him. It was a play apart and separate, wondrous to watch, not without its strange pleasure. That's all for me, he thought. That's all taking place just for me, by God. If he wished, he could linger here in comfort and follow the entire hunt on through its swift phases, down alleys, across streets, over empty running avenues, crossing lots and playgrounds, with pauses here or there for the necessary commercials, up other alleys to the burning house of Mr. and Mrs. Black, and so on, finally to this house, with Faber and himself seated, drinking, while the electric hound snuffed down the last trail, silent as a drift of death itself, skidding to a halt outside that window there. Then, if he wished, Montag might rise, walk to the window, keep one eye on the TV screen, open the window, lean out, look back, and see himself dramatized, described, made over, standing there, limned in the bright small television screen from outside. A drama, to be watched objectively, knowing that in other parlors, he was large as life in full color, dimensionally perfect, and if he kept his eye peeled quickly, he would see himself an instant before oblivion being punctured for the benefit of how many civilian parlor sitters who had been wakened from sleep a few minutes ago by the frantic sirening of their living room walls to come watch the big game, the hunt, the one-man carnival. Would he have time for a speech? As the hound seized him, in view of 10 or 20 or 30 million people, mightn't he sum up his entire life in the last week, in one single phrase or a word that would stay with them long after the hound had turned, clenching him in its metal plier jaws, and trotted off in darkness, while the camera remained stationary, watching the creature dwindle in the distance, a splendid fade-out? What could he say in a single word, a few words, that would sear all their faces and wake them up? "There," whispered Faber. Out of a helicopter glided something that was not machine, not animal, not dead, not alive, glowing with a pale green luminosity. It stood near the smoking ruins of Montag's house, and the men brought his discarded flamethrower to it and put it down under the muzzle of the hound. There was a whirring, clicking, humming. Montag shook his head and got up and drank the rest of his drink. "It's time. I'm sorry about this."
"About what? Me? My house? I deserve everything. Run, for God's sake. Perhaps I can delay them here."
"Wait. There's no use you being discovered. When I leave, burn the spread of this bed that I touched. Burn the chair in the living room, in your room, and your wall incinerator. Wipe down the furniture with alcohol, wipe the doorknobs, burn the throw rug in the parlor. Turn the air conditioning on full in all the rooms, and spray with moth spray if you have it. Then turn on your lawn sprinklers as high as they'll go and hose off the sidewalks. With any luck at all, we can kill the trail in here anyway." Faber shook his hand.
"I'll tend to it. Good luck. If we're both in good health next week, the week after, get in touch. General delivery, St. Louis. I'm sorry there's no way I can go with you this time by earphone. That was good for both of us, but my equipment was limited. You see, I never thought I would use it. What a silly old man. No thought there. Stupid, stupid. So I haven't another green bullet, the right kind, to put in your head. Go now."
"One last thing, quick. A suitcase. Get it. Fill it with your dirtiest clothes, an old suit, the dirtier the better, a shirt, some old sneakers and socks." Faber was gone and back in a minute. They sealed the cardboard valise with clear tape.
"To keep the ancient odor of Mr. Faber in, of course," said Faber, sweating at the job.
Montag doused the exterior of the valise with whiskey. "I don't want the hound picking up two odors at once. May I take this whiskey? I'll need it later. Christ, I hope this works." They shook hands again, and going out the door glanced at the TV. The hound was on its way, followed by hovering helicopter cameras, silently, silently sniffing the great night wind. It was running down the first alley. "Goodbye." And Montag was out the back door lightly, running with the half-empty valise. Behind him, he heard the lawn sprinkling system jump up, filling the dark air with rain that fell gently, and then with a steady pour all about, washing on the sidewalks and draining into the alley. He carried a few drops of this rain with him on his face. He thought he heard the old man call goodbye, but wasn't certain. He ran very fast away from the house down toward the river. Montag ran. He could feel the hound, like autumn, some cold and dry and swift, like a wind that didn't stir grass, that didn't jar windows or disturb leaf shadows on the white sidewalks as it passed. The hound did not touch the world. It carried its silence with it, so you could feel the silence building up a pressure behind you all across town. Montag felt the pressure rising and ran. He stopped for breath on his way to the river, to peer through dimly lit windows of wakened houses, and saw the silhouettes of people inside, watching their parlor walls, and there on the walls, the mechanical hound. A breath of neon vapor spidered along, here and gone, here and gone. Now at Elm Terrace, Lincoln, Oak, Park, and up the alley toward Faber's house. Go past, thought Montag. Don't stop. Go on. Don't turn in. On the parlor wall, Faber's house, with its sprinkler system pulsing in the night air, the hound paused, quivering. No. Montag held to the windowsill. This way. Here. The procaine needle flicked out and in, out and in. A single clear drop of the stuff of dreams fell from the needle as it vanished in the hound's muzzle. Montag held his breath like a doubled fist in his chest. The mechanical hound turned and plunged away from Faber's house down the alley again. Montag snapped his gaze to the sky. The helicopters were closer, a great blowing of insects to a single light source. With an effort, Montag reminded himself again that this was no fictional episode to be watched on his run to the river. It was in actuality his own chess game he was witnessing, move by move. He shouted to give himself the necessary push away from this last house window and the fascinating seance going on in there. Hell. And he was away and gone. The alley, a street, the alley, a street, and the smell of the river. Leg out, leg down, leg out and down. 20 million Montags running soon, if the cameras caught him. 20 million Montags running. Running like an ancient flickery, keystone comedy. Cops, robbers, chasers and the chased. Hunters and hunted. He had seen it 1,000 times. Behind him now, 20 million silently baying hounds ricocheted across parlors. 3 cushions shooting from right wall to center wall to left wall. Gone. Right wall, center wall, left wall. Gone. Montag jammed his seashell to his ear. Police suggest entire population in the Elm Terrace area do as follows. Everyone in every house, in every street. Open a front or rear door or look from the windows. The fugitive cannot escape if everyone in the next minute looks from his house. Ready. Of course, why hadn't they done it before? Why in all the years hadn't this game been tried? Everyone up, everyone out. He couldn't be missed. The only man running alone in the night city. The only man proving his legs. At the count of 10 now. 1, 2. He felt the city rise. 3. He felt the city turn to its thousands of doors. Faster. Leg up. Leg down. 4. The people sleepwalking in their hallways. 5. He felt their hands on the doorknobs. The smell of the river was cool and like a solid rain. His throat was burnt rust and his eyes were wept dry with running. He yelled as if this yell would jet him on, fling him the last 100 yards. 6, 7, 8. The doorknobs turned on 5,000 doors. 9. He ran out away from the last row of houses on a slope leading down to a solid moving blackness. 10. The doors opened. He imagined thousands on thousands of faces peering into yards, into alleys, and into the sky, faces hid by curtains, pale, night-frightened faces like gray animals peering from electric caves, faces with gray, colorless eyes, gray tongues, and gray thoughts looking out through the numb flesh of the face. But he was at the river. He touched it, just to be sure it was real. He waded in and stripped in darkness to the skin, splashing his body, arms, legs, and head with raw liquor, drank it, and snuffed some up his nose. Then he dressed in Faber's old clothes and shoes. He tossed his own clothing into the river and watched it swept away. Then, holding the suitcase, he walked out in the river until there was no bottom, and he was swept away in the dark. He was 300 yards downstream when the hound reached the river. Overhead, the great racketing fans of the helicopters hovered. A storm of light fell upon the river, and Montag dived under the great illumination as if the sun had broken the clouds. He felt the river pull him farther on its way into darkness. Then the light switched back to the land. The helicopters swerved over the city again as if they had picked up another trail. They were gone. The hound was gone. Now there was only the cold river, and Montag floating in a sudden peacefulness, away from the city and the lights and the chase, away from everything. He felt as if he had left a stage behind, and many actors,